From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm Jenna Gibson. In just a few days, President Trump will be heading to Asia for a major trip. He will be spending time in Japan, Korea, China, the Philippines, and Vietnam. And of course, we're really watching carefully, very curious what he will be doing in those various stops, but especially in South Korea. He will be addressing the National Assembly. He will be making a visit to Camp Humphreys and talking to U.S. service members there. But people are going to be watching this very closely, very curious to see exactly what President Trump will say while he's in the Asia Pacific. So here to talk about what some of the expectations are and what we might see from President Trump while he's in Asia and in Korea in particular is Mark Fitzpatrick. Mark is the executive director of IISS Americas, and he is a former U.S. Foreign Service officer as well, and he is also a part of the Korea Economic Institute Board of Directors. So we have a great relationship with Mark, and we're really glad that he is able to join us here today and share some of his insights as we look ahead to Trump's trip in Asia. So with that in mind, let's get started. I want to start a little bit broader first. As I mentioned, Trump is going to several different countries. We'll get to Korea in a little bit, but if you could just give us a little bit of a preview for the whole trip first, what should we expect and what should we be looking for?
This will be Trump's first trip to Asia and his longest foreign trip since taking office in January. This will be a 12-day trip, and that could be grueling for President Trump, who is known to have voiced some displeasure at one of his earlier foreign trips, saying it was too long. And that was a 7-day trip. That was a grueling trip as well. It started off pretty well in Saudi Arabia, but then he ran into some difficulties when he went to Europe. This upcoming trip to Asia, I think, will start pretty well. He starts in Japan, where he has a good relationship with Prime Minister Abe. They've bonded sort of over Trump's personal touch. Then the Republic of Korea, where, of course, America's alliance relationship is so important. It'd get tougher from there, I think. He goes on to China, where Xi Jinping has just had his successful party congress and been elevated to a pantheon of communist leaders of China. And the United States, of course, has many issues with China. He next goes to Vietnam for two different events, most importantly, the APEC summit in Da Nang, Vietnam, which brings together the leaders of Asia plus many of the foreign partners in important economic organization. Then he will be meeting bilaterally with Vietnamese leaders in Hanoi. Finally, he goes to the Philippines, where it originally had been thought that he would be participating in the East Asia summit. But that was just 1 or 2 days too long, and so instead he'll be having bilateral meetings and participating in the opening ceremonial events for the East Asia Summit.
So I'm glad you mentioned this. I was going to ask about the East Asia Summit and the fact that he's going to a couple different pretty big meetings, including APEC, as you mentioned. But I'm seeing a lot of headlines that it's a snub that he's leaving right before the East Asia Summit. Do you see it that way, or do you think people will see it that way?
Well, I've also seen some press commentary calling it a kind of a snub. But I think everybody realizes that this is a president who has a lot of commitments and does get impatient. And, you know, it's better to have the East Asia Summit go well than to have it marred by any missteps or controversies surrounding President Trump. When he gets tired, missteps are more likely, let's be frank. But going back to the the central question, I'm reminded of Woody Allen's quip that 80% of success is showing up. And originally, the East Asia Summit had been scheduled to take place when they thought Trump would show up. So it's unfortunate that he's not able to attend, because I think if he went there, it would be a way to reinforce America's commitment to the region, which he will be doing in all his other stops.
So getting into Korea, One of the big headlines, at least for the last week or so, was will Trump go to the DMZ? And it seems now, I don't know if they've officially confirmed, it seems that he's going to not go to the DMZ and maybe go to Camp Humphreys instead. What is your thoughts on, you know, should he try to go to the DMZ? Would that be a good idea?
You know, it's not so important where exactly he goes in Korea. It's important what he says. And I'm sure that he will say the right things. It looks like he will be going to Camp Humphreys, and he'll be providing reassurances to America's staying power in Korea, to America's commitment to the security of the ally, and to reinforce the strong deterrence vis-a-vis North Korea and demands that North Korea stand down from its aggressive missile testing and nuclear testing. I think it's probably wise that he not go to the DMZ. You know, all of us who have been there know that it's a very highly scripted environment. Visitors are told not to make hand gestures, not to make facial expressions beyond a kind of a solemn face. You don't say things that are out of line. And all of that is contrary to the Trump way of operating. He's prone to say things that are not highly scripted. So it's not so much for his personal security that he wouldn't go to the DMZ at Panmunjom, but more just so it can be better scripted, so that the message sent to North Korea and the reassurance message can be right.
Yeah, I know when I went for the first time, someone in our group had a T-shirt with like a university name on it or something. They made them turn it inside out. You know, they're very, you're right, they're very strictly controlling, you know, even the clothes that you're wearing while you're in the DMZ, so... I also wanted to ask, speaking of the security situation in North Korea, for a while there, up until, you know, between, you know, over the summer, essentially, it was back-to-back missile launches, a nuclear test over Labor Day. Seems things have quieted down a little bit. Do you expect that this trip will provoke North Korea to, you know, start up again? Or what do you see will be North Korea's response?
You know, there's always a lot of speculation about when North Korea will conduct the next provocative missile test or nuclear test. There had been an expectation that on October 20th, a day of significance in North Korea commemorating earlier events, that they would have tested something then. And they didn't. Because I think their testing schedule is not necessarily based on political important days elsewhere, political events elsewhere. I think it's on its own schedule. They may well test something. They may well take it, you know, do it while he's in the region in order to cast a cloud on it. I wouldn't be at all surprised. You are right that we currently are in a bit of a period of calm in terms of several weeks now when North Korea has not tested a ballistic missile. I think it's the longest time of no missile tests since beginning of the year. That's not unusual. There is a pattern over the years. Tests often peak during the summer, and that's partly because the U.S. South Korea joint exercises peak during the summer, and the tests are one way of North Korea to display defiance and deterrence against what they, you know, perceive, or at least they talk about, American hostility. But I'm not betting that this hiatus will last too long. I hope it does, because I think this winter and late fall, early winter are a period of potential window of opportunity. There are no major U.S.-Korea joint exercises until April, and those exercises are always what North Korea gets riled up about. So if North Korea were to continue to not test, maybe, just maybe, there would be a potential for some diplomatic initiative. Not that a diplomatic initiative appears to be on the horizon. But I think most of us who look at the North Korea situation realize that there has to be some engagement, not necessarily to strike a deal with North Korea, but to minimize the dangers of the risky situation we are in, where North Korea might easily misinterpret a Trump tweet or mistakenly believe that a U.S. Reconnaissance flight near North Korea is the beginning of some kind of an attack. So engagement to reduce the risks of North Korean misunderstanding or mistakes is very important.
So you mentioned when we started talking about Korea that part of Trump's main mission should or maybe will be to reassure its allies, to, you know, show this strong face to North Korea while in the South. So what exactly does that look like, especially given some of his stronger rhetoric that we've seen both on Twitter and from his speeches?
Look, reassurance is a standard formula for it. Every president has said variations on the theme. It's very important for President Trump to do so, both because of some of his past statements, particularly as a candidate for the president. He said a lot of things that were not really well-crafted and gave an impression that he was not committed to staying in the Asia-Pacific region or elsewhere in the world for that matter, that he had a kind of an isolationist attitude. And he had questioned whether South Korea and Japan needed to do more for their own defense, and if they didn't, maybe the United States would pull back. Those statements as candidate Trump have not been repeated as President Trump. He's changed very much, and I think that the themes of reassurance will continue as he visits the countries. There are some problem areas, and maybe you're going to ask me about them, but I'll just preempt that by saying that since he's been president, Donald Trump has said a couple things that have riled the South Korean population, and let's hope that he doesn't repeat any of these. You know, he one time mistakenly said that Korea would have to pay itself for the THAAD deployment, something that his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, essentially corrected afterwards. That wasn't the plan. Trump said something just totally wrong about Korea having once been part of China because Xi Jinping told him that. I mean, totally wrong. It's actually the reverse. Parts of China were part of Koryo. And then, you know, what he has said about the Korea-U.S. Trade agreement has created a lot of concerns. And it's not quite clear how he intends to proceed with a earlier avowal to rewrite the chorus. That is going to be a major area of discussion, I think, when he goes to South Korea.
One other tweet that I did want to ask you about was when he, by name, called out President Moon for essentially, you know, trying to engage too much or, you know, being a pushover. I don't remember the exact wording. But after the summit, when President Moon came here, people had a relatively positive view, or it seemed like they had gotten along fine. Maybe not as much as Abe, unfortunately. But then that kind of threw a wrench in that. So what do you see as the relationship
right
there?
Well, so the word that Trump used in that infamous tweet was appeasement or appeaser. I mean, totally false claim, because President Moon Jae-in has been very firm vis-a-vis North Korea. Yes, he campaigned on seeking engagement with North Korea, and he would like to have talks. He, you know, had talked about wanting to resume the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which is actually very problematic because doing so would violate UN Security Council sanctions. But North Korea has given President Moon nothing to work with, so he's been very strong. And yes, when President Moon came to Washington, everything went well. There had been a lot of trepidation about how he's going to avoid all the pitfalls and quicksands and so forth. And maybe the bar was so low that showing up was 80% of success, as Woody Allen said. So I think this time, given the success of Moon's visit to Washington, if that can be repeated when Trump goes to Seoul, that'll be great.
So I don't want to ask you too much about the chorus FTA, because, of course, we do talk about that a lot. I've had a podcast recently just about the chorus FTA. But I'm curious how you think that President Trump and President Moon will balance these two major issues, the North Korea side and the economic side, both of which seem to be very important to this administration.
They are. And they're very important to Trump's trip. Security and trade are the two pillars of his five-nation trip. But I think the security will be the main focus of the first two stops, certainly in Japan and the Republic of Korea, because North Korea's increasing nuclear and missile challenge is so looming that trade really does have to take a back seat when he visits the Republic of Korea. In President Trump's address to the National Assembly, which is not totally unique, but President Obama didn't address the National Assembly, and Trump always likes to do things that Obama didn't do or do them better. In that speech, of course, he'll talk about trade and improving America's economic position, and he might say some things that won't sit entirely well, but the focus of it is going to be security. He knows that. His aides know that. They will have written the right kind of speech, and I think he will deliver it well.
What do you think will be the reception, both from the National Assembly and public? How do you think they will receive President Trump for his first visit?
You know, I think the reception will be polite and welcoming. It won't probably be effusive. I was thinking about the difference when Trump goes to Japan. I think he will get a better welcome there because he hasn't insulted the Japanese public or nation the way he has made some missteps vis-a-vis Korea. So he has some barrier to overcome when he visits South Korea. But I think there is a strong realization of the security need for a strong alliance relationship. And that means getting along very well with President Trump. So it will be beyond polite. It will be a reception acknowledging the very important role that the United States plays and the position of the president in that role.
So as we wrap up, I want to ask about perhaps the elephant in this trip, which is his trip to China.
Yeah.
So of course that might be the most difficult part, as you mentioned at the beginning. When it comes to the North Korea situation, this is a big part of Trump's, at least his publicly stated strategy. You're getting China on board. China is the responsible party here. So how do you think that trip or that part of the trip will go over when it comes to the North Korea question?
So on the North Korea question, I think China will be able to show Trump that they have taken more steps to put pressure on North Korea. They agreed to the last Security Council resolution, which went well beyond previous Security Council resolutions in restricting various forms of trade that North Korea had with countries, primarily China. And they went along with it, and they have been implementing previous resolutions and the current one, not as well as one would like, but there are not a lot of obvious ways that they are abusing the sanctions. So Xi Jinping can point to that and say, look, we cut off part of the oil to North Korea. We cut off North Korea's main exports of coal and of seafoods and textiles. We are restricting the number of North Korean foreign workers that we give visas to here in China. And he'll probably have a list of all the other things that they've done, the export controls that they've put in place. Trump may have his own list of things that he'd like China to do more of, you know, not just limiting the number of North Korean workers, but stopping it altogether. It's a major source of revenue for North Korea. But there's one kind of North Korea visitor to China that Trump might say you should take more of, and that's the refugees. You know, one of the most egregious ways that China protects North Korea is sending back across the border some of the North Korean brave citizens who flee their country. And China doesn't treat them well. They should let them go to the South Korean embassy and let them go to the South Korea. It'd be nice if Trump said that when he's in China. And I think it's an easy thing for China to do. It's not going to cause any rupture with North Korea. It's not going to cause a stream of refugees because North Korea border guards are stopping most of them. But the ones who can get through, gosh, they've gone to all that trouble and they've borne the risks. Don't send them back to North Korea to the jails of their autocratic government.
So I will be really curious to see how this trip goes. I really appreciate your time and your insights here. Before we go, is there anything else that you think is important to keep an eye on?
Well, we haven't talked about the familial trappings of the visit. That's always an important part of any presidential visit. I don't know whether Ivanka will be traveling with him. She's been one of his strongest assets. If she has a way of making friends and inspiring people. So there is a sort of on top of the what is said and statements of reassurance and so forth, there's all those personal attributes. Prime Minister Abe has been very good at this in his so-called skinship with Trump, you know, long handshakes and go way beyond what they should. Xi Jinping has been good at forging a relationship with Trump. I don't quite know how he did it. And, President Moon Jae-in can learn, I think, from those personal ways that others have gotten on Trump's side. And he probably will make some more efforts to do so.
Yeah, I know on the Ivanka side, it's her daughter, I believe, speaks Chinese or is learning Chinese or something. And that's been a big thing.
That was an icebreaker. Too bad she's not learning Korean. Maybe a few words. Maybe Trump could learn a few words of Korean and start off that way. That'd be helpful.
Well, thank you again for taking the time and for sharing with us some of your thoughts.
I'm happy to do so. I greatly appreciate the work of the Korea Economic Institute, and I wish you the best of success.
Thank you, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. As always, please remember to subscribe to our podcasts and also subscribe to KEI's content on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us by searching Korea Econ Inst on Twitter and by searching for the Korea Economic Institute on Facebook. We also have a YouTube page and an Instagram, so be sure to check those out as well. And definitely come back next week for another great episode.